And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Turn on the news these days, and global warming is drowning out a lot of the other stories. And it's about time. So we can take a break and focus on what's happening right now in our own backyards, backwoods, and back rooms. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's nothing like the first week of daylight savings time to assure the body and spirit that spring is in the air. And with spring come many changes. The week's weather portends what may be another year of big weather stories as massive storms this week swept across the mid-country. And speaking of changes in the air, in our first segment, we're off to the nation's capital to learn about some changes in the air quality regulations at the EPA. There's quite a stink being raised about how these changes are sneaking into the regulations originally designed to protect us. Well, that just may not be what the EPA's all about these days. And while we're talking about the dangers hiding in the unseen, in our second segment, we help you avoid the dangers of the real snakes in the grass. Yes, with spring comes the return of the dangers from potential snake bites. We talk with a leading expert who has to deal with 50 and more venomous snake bite victims a year about how to minimize your chances of snake bites and what you need to know should you come face to face with a rattling snake. We then balance off the news with some interesting new plans coming out of the BLM. Following a difficult week or two at the nation's number one public lands agency, we hear about the softer side of government in a unique story that brings us back to the core values of we the people and our great lands. So we've got a lot of ground to cover, and we'd best get started. So first, the news. A brutal spring storm front that swept across the central states, killing 27 and destroying hundreds of homes, begins yet another year in which big weather is predicted to hold a grip on the headlines. The Federal Storm Prediction Center reported 63 tornadoes stretching across Tennessee, Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, and Illinois. Meanwhile, forecasters with the National Hurricane Center are predicting yet another difficult hurricane season scheduled to officially begin on June 1st. Few people dispute the effect that global warming may be playing in the increasingly severe weather that is creating chaos around the globe. The bird flu continues its flight around the world, first appearing in 2003 in Asia. Cases are now confirmed in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. The United States is expected to see its first case of bird flu before the end of this year. The virus has killed 107 people since 2003, but fears exist that a more virulent strain may evolve, which would spread amongst humans and could bring on a worldwide pandemic. Symptoms of bird flu in humans have ranged from typical influenza-like symptoms such as fever, cough, sore throat, and muscle aches, to eye infections, pneumonia, and acute respiratory distress, viral pneumonia, and severe life-threatening complications. On a positive front, environmentalists declared victory on Monday as key Japanese firms quit the whaling business after a pressure campaign. The government of Japan, however, vowed not to change its controversial annual hunt. Fishing giant Nisui and four other firms have promised to turn over their equipment and shareholdings to public interest corporations. This decision completely demolishes the commercial foundation of the Japanese whaling industry, Greenpeace campaigns manager Danny Kennedy said in a statement. It is clear that even in Japan, the message is getting through that whaling is bad for business. Nisui, Japan's largest seafood company, said it would stop distributing and selling whale meat. While Wyoming is fast developing natural gas and oil sites, Governor Dave Freudenthal is drawing a line against leases for drilling sites on 19,000 acres within the Bridger-Teton National Forest. Freudenthal has informed federal officials he opposes plans to lease parcels within the area for drilling while a previous lease sale is appealed. Freudenthal, in a letter, asked the U.S. government to suspend lease sales scheduled for next month until the appeal is resolved. Quoting the governor, "To do otherwise will be perceived by many as a predetermination of the existing appeals." He went on to say, "In the spirit of administrative and judicial economy, and with the knowledge that there are likely to be a significant number of procedurally similar appeals that come as a result of all future leasing in the Bridger-Teton, it seems logical to resolve the December sale appeals before offering additional parcels for lease." About 44,000 acres have been slated for oil and gas leasing in the Bridger-Teton, prompting opposition by a number of groups that want the area off limits to drilling, which is booming in Wyoming. Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated Chief Executive Henry Paulson Friday defended the firm's environmental policy and his roles as chairman of the Nature Conservancy, saying they don't interfere with the global investment bank's performance. Last year, Goldman established an environmental policy vowing to take steps to protect forests and curb development that boosts emissions of greenhouse gases. Their firm pledged to invest $1 billion in renewable energy, form an environmental think tank, and post research on environmental issues. The green is going green. And that's the news. The news from the nation's capital keeps us all wondering what's next. And in that atmosphere, we head to Washington, D.C. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. Falling to the secret powers of the inside deals. This show is a show of good news, and we kind of counter that occasionally with stories that challenge us sometimes. And one that I find particularly personally disturbing, and I'm laughing because it just seems as if this just keeps on going on and on and on, is a story about something that's happening at the EPA, where sort of once again there are these behind-the-scenes machinations and changes in policy that are done, oftentimes in ways that tend to violate trusted traditions of process, to put it lightly. This particular issue deals with a secret EPA rule that would allow more carcinogens in the air, and the person who is very responsible for bringing this story forward is John Walk. He's the Clean Air Director with the NRDC. He's also a senior attorney with the organization. John, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me.
Give us an overview of what's at the crux of this story. What is this? What's the story about this secret draft?
The Clean Air Act, since 1990, has regulated toxic air pollution very effectively in this country. The statute regulates about 188 different types of toxic pollution, many of which are carcinogens. And it does so from about 200 industrial source categories for refineries and chemical plants and factories and other types of industrial plants around the country. Since 1990, we've cut about 1.7 million tons of toxic air pollution on an annual basis as a result of this very effective law. What I learned through a rule that was leaked from sources at the Environmental Protection Agency is that the Bush administration has prepared a proposed rulemaking to change those very effective laws in order to allow industrial facilities to backslide, to actually increase the amount of toxic air pollution that they put into our air, our water, and that deposits onto the food we eat through crops, and that the agency had circulated this proposal for internal review, and regional officials in EPA's offices around the country, 7 of their 10 regional offices, had objected very strongly, very passionately, opposing this rule change, noting that it would be detrimental to the environment, that it would increase airborne toxic pollution in the communities around those plants, and that on top of that, the regions had been cut out of the process of preparing this proposal, and they decried the trend of EPA headquarters excluding them from rule and policy development such as this one.
And that really is quite amazing in the sense that the standard procedure is for these regional offices to really, it's supposed to be kind of a collective effort at crafting our future regulations and standards. So to repeat what you're saying, but I'd like you to go on a little bit about this, they were really cut out of that process.
That's correct. I should note that I was an attorney in headquarters at the Environmental Protection Agency for about 4 years until 2000. And the standard process when I was in the agency was to have work groups with representatives from headquarters and each of the regions, and they would collaborate on the development of rules and policies. And then that collaborative effort would be circulated to higher-ups in the agency, and there would be consensus among the Clean Air Office and the Enforcement Office and the regional offices before something was even put out for public comment for people like you and me to comment on before the rules were changed. This memo makes very clear that that process not only broke down in this instance, but if you read what these officials are saying, that breakdown has become a disturbing trend, their words, at the Environmental Protection Agency, where they are being cut out of the process. And I can offer some insights into why that would be so. Historically, and it remains true under this administration, the regional officials around the country who are closer to the public, the communities where factories pollute, and the states where public health is protected, those officials tend to be more protective of public health and more committed to the environmental and public health mission of the Environmental Protection Agency. By contrast, the officials in headquarters are more often appointed through the political process by the president. And in headquarters of the EPA today, there is a substantial number of former industry lobbyists and officials who are in charge of the programs in headquarters. And in this particular instance, the head of EPA's Clean Air Program is a former industry official who is dictating this policy and receives strong objections from the civil servants around EPA when they learned of this.
What I find disturbing about that is the fact that, you know, the EPA certainly has done some terrific things and it oftentimes is criticized for its failures. The strategy for making decisions which reflected this almost a much more democratic kind of national perspective with experts. Most people working in the EPA are dedicated to really doing exactly what they're supposed to do, and that is to really protect the public from various dangers. In this particular case, it has to do with air. Their expertise is invaluable in really trying to bring about these policies that protect all of us, and it's a wise form of democratic process, and we're best served when that can be maintained. And unfortunately, as they say, there is a trend. It's obvious to anyone who's paying attention to these things that there's a willful attempt to really subvert that process, and that's what we're talking about here. And these people whose job it is to protect us are beginning to be offended, and it's kind of the point where in many cases when you speak out, you get in trouble, but they're preparing to do that because they feel, quite honestly, that it has potentially grievous effects on our ability to regulate and protect our air. They are actually saying that the changes, based on their judgment, could have negative effects.
They say very clearly that they believe the changes will lead to actual increases in toxic and cancer-causing pollution. And they are both mystified and, I say, based upon the language they use, outraged over this step. The headquarters office that prepared this rule under the direction of this former industry lobbyist, interestingly, does not deny that toxic pollution could increase. the draft rule that I obtained says that, in fact, that could happen, that you could have, in some instances, pollution going up. The draft rule goes on to say, however, something quite extraordinary that the regions, I think, object to very strongly. The draft rule says it's more likely that pollution will not go up and that facilities will continue to keep polluting at the same levels. And here I'm going to quote from the rule now. In order to, quote, avoid negative publicity and to maintain their appearance as responsible businesses. So what the draft rule is saying is, yes, it is true that we are weakening the rules on their face, weakening the legal requirements, and eliminating legal requirements that apply today. But it is our prediction that industrial facilities will not increase pollution given the legal right and the opportunity to increase pollution. And the reasons that they put forward are that businesses will want to avoid negative publicity and to maintain their business reputations. Needless to say, that rationale is controversial, and the regions dismiss it out of hand, and the regional officials claim that it is both unfounded and overly optimistic and directly at odds with the on-the-ground experience of regions who, when witnessing industrial behavior, see that if laws are relaxed, then polluters will increase pollution. If the speed limit is raised, people will drive faster. And that is what they point out in their forceful memo.
As I read this, it's almost humorous. And I actually try to be very objective, but my objectivity forces me to say this. I'm reiterating what you're saying, but it's just so amazing that the internal government's case is that businesses, to avoid negative publicity, will opt for the highest levels of protection because they don't want to appear bad. But what I find ironic about that is that that's the mandate out to the world out there, but within the agency itself, the EPA, they're suddenly making themselves subject to extraordinary negative publicity, and also that they're willing to abort the appearance of a responsible agency, although they're supposed to protect that. It's odd.
There are two further ironies that I will point out, since you, I think, honed in on something very interesting. The first irony, which I haven't mentioned yet, is that in addition to allowing industrial facilities to pollute more, as I described, this rule change would also eliminate monitoring and reporting and record-keeping requirements that they're currently subject to. So the additional irony is that the public and the press will be denied information about their toxic levels that's currently required, leading one to ask, how is negative publicity ever going to happen if the press and the public are now being denied the very information that would tell us whether pollution is going up? And the rule never even grapples with that question. It's just a kind of an implicit irony that left me scratching my head.
It reminds me of the hanging chad issue, when people were holding the punch cards up to their head and trying to divine the will and intent, or in this case, the malintent. So anyways, moving on, let's without getting too technical, help the listeners understand the changes. Help us understand these changes.
I noted that the Clean Air Act, since 1990, has been very effective in cleaning up pollution, and toxic pollution in particular. And the reason it's done so is that Congress established a new type of regulating pollution. They instructed EPA to develop rules based upon the greatest reductions in pollution that could be achieved through good technology. They're called technology standards. EPA is supposed to identify the best technologies available in the market and to apply them to different types of industries to get the greatest reduction feasible in toxic air pollution. And the reason Congress took that step is because they cared so very much about toxic pollution that caused cancer and birth defects and the like. So EPA, with that instruction, has issued rules that require very impressive 99%, 95% control requirements to require pollution to be reduced by 95% from what it was before. That has caused pollution in many instances to fall down to levels approaching 1 or 2 or 5 tons of toxic pollution, which, mind you, is still an extraordinary amount since we measure the toxicity of many types of toxic pollution in the ounces. It's so deadly that an ounce is very harmful to the human body. But nonetheless, we've gotten them down to those levels. What this rule would do is to identify a cutoff point and say, if your pollution is below 25 tons annually from a single plant, we are going to allow you to become deregulated. So for that plant that, because it has complied with a very effective law and reduced its pollution down to 1 or 2 or 5 or 10 tons, it suddenly finds itself in a deregulatory windfall where the Bush administration has declared that because it's done such a good job, they're going to be deregulated. And here's the kicker. Once you're deregulated, your pollution can go all the way back up to 25 tons because you're only regulated if you have more than 25 tons. So it's a classic backsliding invitation where plants that have complied with the law to protect us all by reducing down to the lowest levels will be the very ones given the greatest leeway to increase their pollution back up to 25 tons from each plant in America.
And I believe it used to be that any plant that was producing more than 10 tons was required to use these best practices, and they had to install them. Now they've kind of upped that to 25. And, of course, the case is made that, of course, they won't violate these things. They won't allow their pollution to go up because they don't want the bad publicity.
That's correct.
Yeah. What has happened since then? It's getting interesting.
Well, there's been an enormous outcry as a result of this information that's now publicly available. And by the way, I should mention for your listeners that it's available on my organization's website, which is nrdc.org. I've placed the documents and the press release up on our website so that you can examine them yourselves. I wanted the public to have a chance to evaluate for themselves the value of what the Bush administration was planning to do and reach their own opinion.
And also there is a copy of the memo coming back from the regional directors, which I think it's a must read.
It is, and that's much more interesting, and it's written in language that I think people can understand better than the rule itself, which is admittedly technical and complicated. But the region's memo really lasers in on the concerns with why they think this is both unlawful and harmful to air quality and to public health. So there's been an outcry. This story has appeared in newspapers around the country and on some radio shows. And just today in the United States Senate, there was a hearing before the Environment Committee to entertain the president's nomination of this former industry lobbyist I mentioned earlier, who is acting as the head of EPA's air program right now. The president formally nominated this gentleman, a gentleman named Bill Wareham, to be the official head of EPA's air program. And members of the U.S. Senate welcomed him before their committee today and took his testimony. And this change in policy was the subject of actually considerable interest and attention. What was most notable is that Mr. Wareham declined to apologize for this rule change. He did not disavow it. He did not agree with the criticisms of the region. And he even didn't address the question of one senator asking how it was that these officials could have been cut out of the process. I was in the room, and I think it's generous to characterize his remarks as filibustering of sorts. What he said in response to the point that they described their exclusion as a disturbing trend, he said, in effect, well, one of the great things about EPA is that we have really robust internal conversations.
Well, this is nothing new, unfortunately, and I'm trying to be objective and fair, but it's getting a little tiresome, quite honestly, the way in which this process, the change through secret executive fiat, changes, significant changes that affect us all. It's a strategy that is apparently willfully designed to do end runs around otherwise existing legislation and laws. It's quite honestly disturbing. And then I guess, again, to reiterate what you just said, the fact that the officials whose job it is to work with their people in the field, there's a distancing that's happening. And it doesn't bode well for the people who are out there in the field. I think they're getting upset.
Well, and it's not what the American people should expect of the Environmental Protection Agency. They trust our government officials and that agency in particular to safeguard public health and the environment and to clean up and address some very real public health troubles that we still have in this country. We've made a tremendous amount of progress in this country due to the good work of the EPA. And let me echo your sentiment earlier that there are some fine public servants who work there. But it doesn't take many individuals in headquarters or much of a thing, really, to completely take over the agenda of the agency and to redirect it into a direction that industry prefers. All it takes is really one person at EPA with support from the White House through the agency that works with EPA in the White House to decide to change course so radically. And that's what happened here. That's how this ball got rolling. And it really wasn't until the end of the line that the regions learned of this and objected so strongly. And now, fortunately, we're having a robust social discussion and debate about whether this is what the EPA should be about and whether they should be allowing more cancer-causing pollution into the air by backsliding from stronger protections that we already have on the books.
You know, I meant to watch that hearing. Was there a confirmation vote taken?
No. The Senate will go into Easter recess shortly. I believe they will return to their districts for a period of about 2 weeks. And then the vote on the nomination in that committee will probably occur in about 2 weeks' time.
Do you think enough issues are raised to make this a difficult confirmation?
I think this will be a difficult confirmation, and both a Republican and Democratic senator acknowledged as much at the hearing today.
Well, a lot is being found out right now about the process and the outrage is spreading, as it should.
Well, I believe that there should be a public airing of the policies that this nominee created over the past 5 years at EPA. He happens to have been an architect of reversible air pollution measures of the Bush administration, so that record was the subject of much discussion today.
Well, bottom line is, so now what? Is there anything that the American public can actually do in these regards? I mean, how can we change this strategy that is being foisted upon us? I mean, we're ultimately becoming victimized by this.
We are, but there are plenty of good people still in Congress and at the Environmental Protection Agency who need to know that the public doesn't support or appreciate things like this. And it's almost silly hearing myself saying that because, of course, who supports more cancer in the air, carcinogens in the air? But the truth is that they will proceed with this proposal. Mr. Wareham made that clear at his confirmation hearing that they plan to go full steam ahead. And frankly, the only thing that would stop them is sufficient public outrage with the public contacting their members of Congress and flooding the head of the EPA, Stephen Johnson, with emails to make clear that this is not the direction they want this country going in. Barring that type of public outrage, I believe that EPA will go right ahead with this proposal.
Well, John, once again, give your website address so the people who want to find out more about this can easily find it.
The website for the Natural Resources Defense Council is nrdc.org, and there is a link on our homepage with a press release talking about an EPA proposal that would allow more carcinogens in the air. You can click on that link and take you to where you can obtain this EPA regional memo, as well as the draft rule and my analysis and description of the controversy.
John Walk with the Natural Resources Defense Council, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. I really appreciate it.
We need to clean the air, and the best way to do so is with the light of knowledge, which we bring you each week here on the Wildside News. And in that spirit, we're heading west to California, where we're taking a walk on the wild side, where you need to watch your step when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. And record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's spring, and life is bursting out all over. Change is what keeps the wonder alive. And change keeps happening in what we know about our world, including some old myths that need revision. We take you next into some new ways of thinking about heading out this spring and summer into your yards and forests, byways and beyond. In a moment, we come face to face with one of the greatest dangers facing even the casual recreationist when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News. We talk each week about the wonders and joys of nature, about the communion with other intelligent beings, about the magic of the wild creatures. It's also amazing and important to our well-being. But as in all of life, with the good comes the bad. And we'd be less than fair if we didn't, once in a while, keep us aware of those things that might just reach out and bite us. Well, here we are in April, which means spring, and that usually means that people start to get that desire to head out onto the trails and start getting that lust for the outdoors. Nothing better than that. And as you do and you prepare to get out into the outdoors, there's a lot of things that one has to be aware of, you know, just being aware of the usual things, safety, for example, and preparing for changing weather. But one thing that people think about, but that perhaps don't think about as seriously as they might, without overemphasizing it, is the possibility of snake bites. And so in the interest of public information, we're talking with someone who has real hands-on experience with this. Joining us now from Loma Linda, California, is Dr. Sean Bush, who is a staff emergency physician. He works in emergency rooms, and he deals with snake bites. Dr. Bush, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much.
Well, our topic today is going to be snake bites, and apparently you have had some real experience with this. Why don't you, first of all, just kind of give us a background on how it is that you have such an interest and specialization in this area.
Well, I've been fascinated by reptiles all my life. One of my very first pets was a venomous snake, and I was about 5 years old. My grandfather gave it to me, but it wasn't dangerously venomous, but it was a hognose snake, but it was venomous nonetheless and makes a good story, but it kind of sparked a fascination that lasted my whole life. And now I'm doing emergency medicine up here, and I treat patients for snake bites. We kind of have a lot of snake bites that happen here because we're in an area where urbanization meets the wilderness, you know?
Uh-huh. And that's possibly one of the most dangerous areas. In very many urban and suburban areas, there are snakes.
Absolutely. It is one of the most dangerous areas, you know, and in deep wilderness areas are not as dangerous, I guess, because people don't get out there as much, I guess present audience excluded. And, you know, the inner cities, there's not quite as many snake bites, of course, because of habitat destruction and there's not as many animals. But right here, out in Southern California, you get a lot of urban sprawl just spreading into wilderness areas, whether it's the mountains or the desert. And that's where a lot of people come in contact with snakes, fortunately and unfortunately.
Well, the statistics are kind of interesting. The American Hiking Society is really focusing on this because they have people who get out into the woods and hit into the trails. They have some interesting statistics. One is that about 75 million people actually head out into the trails in a year. And during that time, there's about 45,000 snake bites. Of those, about 7,000 to 8,000 are venomous. And of those, perhaps there's a dozen deaths per year, deaths being the ultimate fear. So in terms of people going out and thinking if they get bitten by a snake that they're going to die, which is kind of one of the myths, the urban myths, and suburban and rural myths, I guess, quite honestly, the chance of dying from a snake bite are fairly rare.
Sure, sure. It's rare. I mean, in fact, those statistics you quoted are probably a couple of decades old, and nowadays probably fewer than half a dozen people die per year from snake bites, if that many. And I think probably the secret to survival is rapid access to emergency medical care, anti-venom, and state-of-the-art medical care. And so for the hikers, I think that it's important to note that one of the best pieces of first aid that you can have for snake bite is a cell phone. And if you get bitten, call 911, and you'd be surprised at some of the places where we can get you. You know, I volunteer with the Sheriff's Air Rescue here and with San Bernardino County, and we've extracted some people out of some pretty deep wilderness situations, and that cell phone comes in real handy when you're trying to locate somebody on the ground from a helicopter.
Sure, exactly. You know, they can call up and say, "Hey, I see you there. Here I am." Exactly.
Right.
A little later on, we're going to talk about what happens if you get bit. Let's talk about how you can avoid getting bitten. What are some of the things that people should be aware of in terms of trying to avoid being bitten by a snake?
Well, you know, most bites are what I call intentionally interactive, and that means the person's trying to mess with a snake or kill the snake or get too close. And so the vast majority of bites could be avoided if people would just leave the snake alone, you know, don't mess with it. I mean, it's kind of un-American. I mean, isn't there a saying that goes, "Don't tread on me," that kind of rings true for this situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so if you just leave them alone and appreciate them from a distance, I mean, that's probably the best thing you can do at prevention. Now, you know, I've treated mountain bikers and rock climbers and people who have been accidentally bitten. You know, it's not their fault. It's not under their control always. You know, you can do some other things too to avoid being bitten. You know, if you go out into the snake's environment, you know, the wilderness, I mean, do things like wear protective clothing, wear boots when you can, put your hand in places where you can't see, obvious things like that.
Mm-hmm. I believe that snakes would have a very difficult time going through a leather boot.
As a matter of fact, we did a study, and small snakes very often, this is not 100%, but small snakes often can't bite through your jeans. Now, on occasion, a big rattlesnake can bite through a leather boot. I've seen it happen, and a fang can certainly penetrate a boot and deliver, a serious envenomation. But that's the exception rather than the rule, and most of the time, well, I mean, you do everything you can to try to avoid getting bitten.
Mm-hmm. So wearing protective clothing is a first layer of defense.
Well, I would say the first layer of defense is just don't mess with the snake.
Good point.
Because they're not out to attack you. They're not trying to eat you, or they don't want to seek a fight with you, and that's a snake's last resort.
Mm-hmm.
So first line of defense is leave them alone, and then the next, because they'll more often than not leave you alone in those inadvertent situations when you need some protection. I mean, protective clothing is a good line of defense.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's say you're walking along a trail. And this has happened to me, and I'm telling you, it's a wake-up call. I'm also very cautious. I lived in the desert southwest around Santa Fe in New Mexico, and you had to be aware of rattlers all the time. Anytime you're outdoors, you had to be watching where you were going and being conscious, because they blended in so perfectly with the environment, you almost couldn't see them.
Sure.
But I found myself a few times, where there I was, and I ran across a snake, and then all of a sudden they put on their warning behaviors, which is a variety of things, the rattling, the coiling, the pulling back of the head. If you find yourself in that situation, there's kind of levels of danger. One is just how close you are. Talk about the capacity for a snake in that situation to attack. What's going to happen depending on sort of your proximity?
Well, snakes can only strike about a half to maybe up to two-thirds their body length. And out here in Southern California, the biggest snake rarely exceeds 6 feet. So, I mean, if you stay at least 6 feet away, and for most people that's, you know, a couple of big steps back, you're out of the snake strike range. And you can appreciate and enjoy the snake at that distance. You know, they're fascinating animals. They're fun to watch. They're interesting. But they don't move that fast. They can only crawl at a rate of about 2 or 3 miles per hour. But if you get in their strike range, they can strike extraordinarily fast, much faster than you can pull away.
I believe it's about a 50th of a second. It happens extremely fast.
Yeah, the nerve can't travel to your brain and back, you know, for you to pull your hand away. The snake, got you if you want to strike at you, if you're in the strike range.
I've been in a couple situations where, for example, I was stepping and literally saw a snake under where I was stepping, and my reaction just literally, I just leapt back reflexively. The snake could have bit me if it wanted to, but it didn't. I think that, and I'm trying to reinforce the point here, that snakes really have no interest in attacking. As a matter of fact, they're probably going to only do that if they sense somehow that you're willfully or even accidentally, but I mean that they have the sense that something is attacking them.
Right. I mean, striking you, biting you, and making contact with a human is the last thing that a snake wants to do. It's very counterproductive to survival if you're a rattlesnake. So they don't want to do that. In fact, most of the time, if you come across a snake, it'll just freeze. It won't move, and hopefully you'll overlook it. And that's actually what the snake wants to do first. Is it wants to be missed. It wants you not to see it. So that's why a lot of snakes have camouflage. And there's other types of snakes, like coral snakes, that are brightly colored, but they have a different message. They want you to think that they're dangerous, but they don't want to make contact. That's the last thing they want to do, because it's counterproductive to their survival.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say that you find yourself, you're walking along, and suddenly you're aware that there is a snake within striking distance. What's the best thing to do at a point like that?
Well, you know, I think the best thing you do is use common sense and just to stay out of the snake strike range if you can. If you get into the strike range, you know, you got to get out of it. I mean, you just have to get out of it. You can't stay there indefinitely. And sometimes, I mean, I just tell people to step back. If you kind of are deliberate and careful about your movements, a lot of times you can just step right out of a snake strike range. I mean, I've stepped too close to rattlesnakes before. And if you just, you know, step back deliberately and slowly, they probably won't strike you. I mean, there's no guarantees. It is a wild animal, and it is unpredictable. But you have no real option. If you're too close, you need to get farther, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happens if you're unfortunate enough to be bitten by a snake. Now, just because you're bitten by a snake doesn't mean necessarily that it's a venomous snake. I've been bitten by garter snakes and bull snakes, and many of them even act like and imitate rattlers, and I'm telling you, I one time mishandled a snake. Again, I was messing around with a snake, thinking I knew what I was doing, and it bit me, and it coiled up. It shook its tail.
Sure.
And I'm thinking it's a rattler, but because of where I was in Minnesota, they didn't have rattlers there. And I just kind of kept watching and hoping I wouldn't swell up. So non-venomous snakes bite as well. But let's say that you are bitten by a snake. Let's talk about some of the things that people should do. And I'm going to preface this by saying that as I've grown up, what I've heard you're supposed to do, this is what I think is common knowledge or belief about what you should do. Number one is tourniquet. Right away, put a tourniquet between the bite and your heart. Number two.
Oh, now see, I got to stop you right there. I just can't even. I can't stand to hear that perpetuated.
Well, we're going to destroy this. We're going to totally destroy this. That's why I'm bringing it up, because a lot of people think, oh, that's what I heard. I'm just saying what people have, and I appreciate that. But then the other is to lance and suck out the venom. Let's talk about what you know to be the proper action.
Well, first of all, like you say, not all bites are venomous. There are lots of snakes that sort of resemble rattlesnakes that can be mistaken for rattlesnakes that can and do bite people, like gopher snakes or bull snakes, and they'll imitate and rattle their tail and make a lot of noise. But, you know, here in Southern California, rattlesnake has a very characteristic look and has a blunt tail with a rattle on the end. The tail does not taper like most snakes that aren't dangerous would. And we don't recommend that old stuff from decades ago, the Boy Scouts cut and suck the venom out. First of all, you can't suck the venom out, no matter how hard you suck. And we've experimented with this, and we've even used, this venom sawyer extractor device, and it doesn't work. It doesn't pull venom out, and it can actually make things worse. It can cause damage. And I certainly wouldn't recommend cutting, you know, because you don't know if you're cutting over nerves or arteries or veins or whatever. And tourniquets, you know, those aren't any good either. I mean, it's not good to put a tourniquet on, particularly if you're going to have it on for a prolonged period of time. Now, there's some controversy regarding a technique that they use in Australia called pressure immobilization. And for certain snake bites, like Australian snake bites, there's some benefit because it's going to slow the spread of the venom. But with rattlesnakes, the problem is more related to the local effects, and it can cause such intense local effects that you don't necessarily want to localize it or to keep it from spreading because it can intensify the effect. So pressure mobilization is placing an ACE wrap and a splint on it as tight as you would like a sprain. But I would probably reserve that for the very rare snake bite like a Mojave rattlesnake bite that where you wouldn't expect there to be local effects or severe local effects and there might be very severe systemic effects. So for the masses, I wouldn't recommend any first aid. I think the best first aid is calling 911. And if there's question regarding the identity of the snake, a lot of these cell phones have camera phones. And you can take a digital image and your doctor can see right there, is it a gopher snake? Is it a rattlesnake? What is it? Right there on the camera phone. And you can take the picture from at least 6 feet away to keep yourself out of danger. So just another reason to carry your cell phone, especially if it's a camera phone, in your pack. Identification can help. You know, if you're not sure what kind of a snake is, take a picture of it. It may make a difference if it's a gopher snake or a rattlesnake. I mean, that's important to know. And doctors should be able to distinguish a rattlesnake from a gopher snake, for instance. So, but if you don't have a cell phone, I get this question all the time. What if I'm deep in the wilderness, far from medical care, what should I do?
Right, that is kind of the challenge.
And, of course, 911 is optimal if you have that. But if you don't, I mean, you're just going to have to get yourself to medical care, whatever it takes. And, you know, every circumstance is slightly different. I mean, generally, you should hike with a partner if you can. You know, it's kind of like having a dive buddy. Or anytime you go into a wilderness situation, it's better to have, it's better to go more with more than one person. So that in case of a situation like this, you know, if you get snake bitten or whatever, that you can send for help. Or you can be carried to help or whatever it takes. But if you're by yourself and you're bitten by a snake and you don't have a cell phone, I mean, you're faced with no choice but to hike out to get medical care, and that's what you got to do.
What would you recommend people doing specifically in that situation? What actions should they take at that point?
Well, you try to be calm. Try not to panic. You can do some things, like if you're bitten on the, if you're bitten anywhere, you can start removing things like rings because you're going to swell up. Snake venom makes you swell. And if you're bitten on the hand, for instance, and your hand swells up, you can't get the ring off. I mean, that kind of creates a tourniquet effect.
Yeah.
So you can remove rings. And basically, the bottom line is just get to medical care.
Mm-hmm. You're basically saying get to help. Get walk your way out.
Well, if that's your only option, first of all, be prudent. You know, carry a cell phone. Go with a partner. And so, if it's your last resort and you have to walk, I mean, that's the only choice you have. I mean, you've kind of painted yourself into a circle, you know. Get to to medical care is the bottom line, whatever it takes.
Now, from the point that you're bitten by a venomous snake, and we're talking now about this worst-case scenario, or a situation where you could be in the woods, but you still don't have your cell phone, you got to walk out. What kind of time frame, I realize it varies, but what sort of general time frame do you have before this potentially starts becoming more difficult? And then the second question would be, what are the signs that things are getting out of control?
Well, the time frame is extraordinarily variable. I mean, you could die in minutes or you could die in weeks. It depends on what you die from if it's a fatal snake bite. There have been cases of anaphylaxis and people are dead within minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have kidney failure, well, that usually takes a couple of weeks to kill you, untreated.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends. I mean, the sooner you get the anti-venom, the better.
Mm-hmm.
The sooner you get the medical treatment, the better you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how people survive in the United States, is, like I said, rapid access to medical care and state-of-the-art medical care and anti-venom. IV fluids are helpful. So that's the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the second part of your question?
What would be signs that things are becoming difficult for you? What would you begin to experience? I realize that varies again, too.
Well,
changes in your mental state, obviously fear is one thing, but I'm talking about perhaps induced by venom, physical feelings of illness or discomfort.
Some of the first things that are very common to happen after snake bite are swelling. You can swell up, and usually it starts at the bite. And moves up the extremity. If you're bitten on the arm and the leg, your arm or your leg will start to swell. You can have bleeding problems. You can have muscle twitching, difficulty breathing, and that's kind of the progression. You can have low blood pressure. It can progress to shock, and so that your brain is not perfused, and you can have some mental status changes associated with that too.
Now, how about ice packs or heat packs or anything like that?
You know, it doesn't work. It doesn't help. In fact, it can, and that too can cause more problems. I mean, people get overzealous with ice packs, and in days past, they used to recommend, you know, submerging the bitten extremity in ice, and that was called cryotherapy. But then people would get frostbite wounds on top of their snake bite wounds, and you know, two wrongs don't make a right, and people don't get better that way.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help with the envenomation, and it can cause additional insult to injury. So it's not recommended.
So finally, a person makes it to medical care. What are they looking at that point?
Well, once you get to medical care, you're going to see how the envenomation is progressing, if it's a venomous bite or a dry bite. And then there's anti-venom to be given. You know, for pit viper bites, we use Crofab.
How is that typically administered?
Well, it's given intravenously. You start off with 4 to 6 vials, and you try to get control of the envenomation syndrome. And you want to see if you can stop the envenomation from progressing in terms of swelling and local effects. And then you want to see if you can correct any bleeding abnormalities that a patient might have or any other systemic abnormalities. Mm-hmm. And we follow a patient's labs. And
how long does it usually take before things are stabilized? I realize all of these things are variable.
Sure.
Completely variable. And as you say, depending on a person's own sensitivity to the bite, and just there's so many variables. But typically, you know, since you've treated, what, 50 or 60, you say, bites, what is it, per year, is it?
Right.
Yeah. Well, then you have some experience. Give us a sense of, you know, from the time that a person comes into your care, how long do you have to follow this, and kind of what are some of the variables?
Well, I mean, as I said, the sooner you get anti-venom on board, the better. I mean, it progresses over time, and if you get the anti-venom on board, you can usually get things stabilized within 24 hours. But it takes, then you can have recurrence phenomenon, so it can take a couple of weeks for that to clear up. So really, I guess the subacute phase of rattlesnake bite treatment is about 2 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to monitor even longer than that for a full return of function. And sometimes people with really bad bites may not get full function until, you know, up to a year after the snake bite. And some people never regain full function. I mean, a small percentage of patients have permanent disability and permanent sequelae from snake bite, like the loss of a finger or a toe, or the loss of the function of a finger, for instance.
We discussed briefly some of the costs of this. That alone is a good reason to be prepared. Make sure that you go out with your cell phone, properly dressed. Be aware. Don't put your hands in the wrong place. Don't go walking through tall grass. It's just all the common sense things, because quite honestly, the backside of this is what it could cost you for the treatments.
Absolutely. Medicine is expensive, particularly sophisticated medications like anti-venom. I think the cost of pharmacy for Crofab, for instance, is about $1,000 a vial. And our starting dose, as I mentioned, was 4 to 6 vials. And before you get out of the hospital, you may have a dozen vials or more. So that's quite a lot for just the anti-venom. On top of that, you have to have expensive monitoring, and doctors and nursing can be expensive, and other medications possibly, like intravenous fluids. You may need ICU care or close observation, lab draws. It's quite expensive. Mm-hmm. Medicine is expensive.
So if you do end up being unfortunate enough to be bitten by a snake, it's going to cost you some dough.
It's going to cost somebody some dough, you know. I mean, we're going to treat everybody. I mean, that's the law. You know, emergency physicians treat anybody who comes. A snake bite is definitely an emergency medical condition. So it's nice if you have insurance, of course. So there's places where people can go where there's other coverage, I guess, like county systems and that sort of thing. But snake bite's an emergency medical condition. You got to seek medical care immediately.
We're talking with Dr. Sean Bush, who's a staff emergency physician. You've also taken this information and made it available to the public through the Animal Planet channel.
Right. I try to talk about, you know, educate people about snake bite as best I can in every forum I can think of or in every forum I'm invited. And one of the places is we had a show. It's rerunning right now. It's called Venom ER, and it's on Animal Planet. In fact, I think the next episode airs this Saturday, April 8th at 1 p.m. It's an interesting show. It basically just chronicles my treatment of patients with venomous bites and stings. And one of the predominant, one of the most dangerous animals in the U.S. of A. is the rattlesnake, and I see a lot of rattlesnake bites.
That'll be this Saturday, April 8th on Animal Planet at 1 p.m. Pacific time, a great chance for us to see you in person.
Right, and if you want to watch more of the episodes, just check the Animal Planet website and do a search for Venom ER.
Terrific. I want to thank you for giving us this extremely useful information. I think it's helped people really realize the best actions if they should be unfortunate enough to find themselves bitten, and also some great preventative measures that they can take so that that never happens or the chance is totally minimized. Dr. Sean Bush, thanks a lot for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Sure thing. I hope it's helpful.
It's all part of being a responsible hiker to enjoy your adventures prepared at all times for the real world of wonders. There's literally thousands of miles of trails to go hiking or biking on, and when we return, we look at how the nation's leading land managers are planning to make your outdoor experiences ever more meaningful when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you ever taken the time to imagine, really, what's involved in managing our wild places? Our public lands serve a myriad of uses, from hiking and camping, biking and kayaking, to grazing and drilling for oil and gas. How do those who have to balance the values and uses of our vast public lands think about and manage these competing uses? You just may be surprised to hear what they're talking about these days. We'll find out when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. Everyone knows about our national parks, Yellowstone, Redwoods, Canyonlands, the Everglades. And America's grand forests provide legendary recreational opportunities. But the majority of public lands, often not even recognized as such because they aren't necessarily marked with popularly recognized names, provide a wealth of resources to all of us, not least of which is almost unfettered recreational opportunities. We often hear about the places where competing uses overlap, where natural gas wells encroach on grazing, or where horsemen and hikers must share a trail. It's a daunting task to plan for proper use. It's been a long time in the making, and land use planning has a long legacy of changing strategies. Well, there's some new language appearing in the management manuals. These are some exciting times for those who have spent a lifetime finding the balance. Well, as all of my listeners know, the issues of public lands are very complex. There's been a lot of discussion about the future of public lands, the utilization, how best to use them, who owns them, how to administer them properly. One of the organizations that is very much involved, more than any other, in terms of administering public lands is the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management. We're looking for some good news from the BLM, and I think we found some really interesting new ideas that are emerging that I think people will find very interesting. And to help us understand more about this, we're talking with Don Bruns. He's a recreation planner who works out of the Colorado State Office up in Denver. Don, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sydney.
How long have you been with the BLM?
Since the mid-70s.
So you have quite a history in terms of public lands and their uses. And your specialization is recreation?
Yes, it is.
How did you find yourself getting involved with recreation as your focus?
Well, it's a good question, Sydney. I'm a farm kid, grew up in the Midwest, and grew up with a history of asthma and realized I couldn't be a farmer, but was always interested in nature and found out I could be healthy out in the West. And one thing led to another, and I got very interested personally, as a participant, and found out that recreation enriched my life, and one thing led to another, and here I am.
Well, and of course, BLM offers extraordinary recreational opportunities. Why don't you just give us a quick overview of some of the opportunities that people have on public lands?
In terms of activities, we look pretty much the same as the other agencies, but that changes when we start looking at experiences and the kinds of benefits that people get out of their outings. Here in Colorado, for example, we have a lot of the state's major rivers, so there's lots of river recreation. There are lots of trails and undeveloped settings, so it's a chance for people to experience some of the Old West, as it were, get away from the rat race of the intensive recreation and have an opportunity to reconnect with culture and community. So there are chances to go on scenic drives, a lot of opportunities to see heritage tourism kinds of things with not just cultural and historic, but also natural features, which are part of our natural heritage. And, of course, the traditional hunting, fishing, bird watching, wildlife watching, but a lot of off-highway vehicle use, mountain biking, hiking, and of course, wilderness as well.
One of the challenges that I know BLM specifically faces, and that is very often you'll find communities right in the middle of your lands. And so there is this interface between communities and public lands, and I think that's where, in particular, this kind of new vision, a new approach to management really comes into play. And this is something that is defined as benefits-based management, BBM, from the BLM. Give us a sense of what benefits-based management actually means.
Well, it's really managing for the value-added outcomes that recreation yields to our lives. It kind of goes back, Sydney, to the old days of the birth of the recreation movement in the U.S. At that time, in the height of the industrial age, it was found that recreation could relieve some of the stress of working in an industrial setting for long hours. Recreation was something that improved one's quality of life and was therefore good. So recreation is something that enhances our quality of life. It gives us satisfying experiences psychologically, but it also improves our lives psychophysiologically as well as economically in terms of our own quality of life. It can improve our families, can improve our communities, can improve our economies, and hopefully improves the environment as well. At the same time, it can do the opposite. It can lead to disbenefits. So how we manage really determines the difference.
And what we're really saying is that public lands and lands and the opportunity to interface and get out there is an important part of our culture and our society.
That's exactly right, Sydney. Mm-hmm. It's that connection, like you said, BLM public lands are so closely interfaced with rural communities that to visit the rural West is to visit the public lands, is to visit those communities. And they really hitchhike one off of the other. So this is increasingly for lots of folks, this is the chance to sort of reconnect with our rural roots. And particularly in the Intermountain West, the Rocky Mountain West, within the last decade, there's been a substantial in-migration, and that's not just, some of that's retirees, some of that is second homes, even business relocations. Why should people, we're hearing, beat their heads up against the wall of urban traffic when they could actually relocate and move their businesses out, and that's happening increasingly. So these are folks who also find out that the public lands are not just a nice place to visit, but it's nice to live nearby so you can have close-to-home access for enriching outings on the public land.
So in terms of benefits-based management, which is a new thing added to the land use planning manual for the BLM, just recently, as a matter of fact, this is the mandate is coming down to implement this. What is this bringing that's new to the process of land management that you think perhaps didn't exist before?
Well, we've always recognized the value of recreation, like I said, but I think that somewhere in the intervening 100 years since the recreation movement began, it became very easy to count, as it were, widgets, how many miles of trails we built, how many interpretive exhibits we put up, how many special designations, how many recreation sites we've built, how many areas we have, et cetera, on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But the real question is, so what? Why do all of this? So this really answers the why question. And the why really is the value that recreation potentially adds to the lives of individuals, to households and communities, to economies, and to the environment. And so benefits are really defined as satisfying experiences, as well as the improved conditions or the prevention of worse conditions to those different kinds of benefit recipients. So really what has happened is, in the old days where we wrote management objectives for getting things done, and now we're writing management objectives for the kinds of primary outputs, those recreation opportunities defined as activities, experiences and benefits, and then their attainment. It's that old saying, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. So this is the whole point of this, is to try to decide what are the real products for what kinds of customers, because we can't be all things to all people and then work backwards.
Well, I'm trying to get a sense of how this actually becomes implemented then in the field. BLM has employees. They're now under this new mandate. For those people who are beginning to be trained and skilled in this new approach to the benefits-based management, what is their mandate? They go into a community associated with public lands. Tell me what they actually do.
Well, the mandate really hasn't changed in terms of what we've always been supposed to do. In a multiple-use agency, we're managing for a variety of uses. Recreation is one of them, but what we're really doing now is trying to find out what is it that our customers want, to identify, really, markets and to identify what kinds of outcomes and specifically their preferences for activities, different kinds of recreation activities, different kinds of experiences, and different kinds of longer-lasting benefits. And some of those outcomes are setting-dependent, so it's some are not, some depend just on the actions of the providers, which, of course, BLM is not a sole-source provider, so particularly because we're an agency that so closely interfaces with rural communities, it's private business and industry that provides essential services, whether those be on-site outfitters and guides, tour operators, or whether they be folks who provide retail services, equipment, gear rental, or even the entire hospitality industry, lodging, restaurants, whatever. And then local governments as well in terms of maintaining basic infrastructure, essential supporting infrastructure. So it's really a question of just hooking up with all of our constituents and finding out our customers and finding out just what it is that is valued. And, of course, you can't be all things to all people, so there's a question of doing analyses of supply and demand. I suppose in the old days we did those largely on the basis of activities, and now we're looking at what really matters to people, Sydney. What comes to mind is Leopold said at one time, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to save all the pieces. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what we're trying to do, make sure we address all those pieces that matter to our customers.
That's really great. Let's look at three scenarios. Let's talk about some small town in Utah where things are fairly dry and sparse. Let's talk about an area perhaps in Colorado where you have access to the high mountains. And someplace along a coastal area. Obviously, there's different needs, different benefits. How do you determine that? Do you go and sit in a restaurant and talk to people, or how do you gather that information from those local populations?
That's a great question. Really, there are several levels of doing that. It's surprising what we can find out by just doing informal interviews, sitting down and talking to, even in a recreational setting. I was on vacation up in Alaska this summer, and one of my colleagues up there said, we want to have you help us with a couple of seminars. And while I was out vacationing, I just did some informal interviews on my own and just found out really where people are coming from, who they are, where they're going, what are the alternative destinations, and what are they looking for. And of course, if we are thinking about that idea that Leopold espoused, saving all the pieces, then we're going to be asking different kinds of questions than we might otherwise have asked. And we'll ask questions like, so how did you plan your outing? What kinds of things matter to you? If these are vacationers, that's a different question than folks who are out for an evening ride on a mountain bike, for example. But those questions start, and of course, you know, if you ask people about their recreation outings, they'll love to tell you. And the information just starts pouring out, and you really find out how relevant this particular area is to some of the other alternative opportunities. That's kind of how we go about it as we tie in, and this is new for most of us because we've done this before, but it's new in terms of making sure that we gather the right kinds of information and really find out to what degree these things matter, which kinds of outcomes matter. For different customers, and really in terms of your illustration, Sydney, it probably doesn't matter whether it's a remote community in Utah or if it's a high mountain community here in Colorado or if it's somewhere along the California coast. In one sense, the issues are the same. People are still looking to improve the quality of their life, find some stress relief, improve their health, improve family bonding, develop a closer relationship with nature, all these kinds of things. That's kind of how we go about it. And in some cases, we do focus groups, which are really small group meetings to just get a better idea specifically what are the dimensions that matter to people. And, the old idea of a focus group was consensus building, and of course, there needs to be, to some degree, we have to figure out which customers we're working with. But the genuine focus group, as Richard Kruger laid it out in his great book on focus group meetings, how to really do them and make them matter, it's really trying to identify the dimensions that are most important to our customers.
What I find interesting is there's some new languaging that's happening here that we don't usually associate with land management. One of the terms that you used was family bonding. That's very interesting. That's an interesting discussion in terms of how to utilize land. Let's talk about that if we can, and maybe it's premature, but I'd be curious. So if you were to look at what we'll say, again, out in Utah, how would you go about trying to plan for improving the benefit of family bonding in an area like that?
Here's an illustration. We have the McInnis Canyon's National Conservation Area, which is west of Grand Junction, we actually have a completed plan that is a benefits-based plan in that area. That's where Cocopelli's Trail starts out, and it goes down to Moab, Utah. It's probably a mountain biking mecca wouldn't be an inappropriate descriptor.
That's the center of it.
Yep. And so where people start out at Fruta, they go through an area called Mack Ridge, and then they go into an area called Rabbit Valley, and then they cross over the state line, and they go all on into Utah. Years ago, when the Colorado Plateau Mountain Bike Association built those trails, working as volunteers with BLM, they basically said, BLM, don't you screw this up, because we really want, over here on Mack Ridge, we really want this to be single-track riding. We don't want the trails to be too well-developed, because the purpose here is for fitness riding, for developing our skills and abilities. In fact, it's an area that's close to town, so it's a chance for people to get out, burn off some steam, release some stress, get fit, and breathe in some of that beautiful outdoor air. That trail, as it goes west and across the Salt Creek, then it comes along into some places where there's old, basically four-wheel drive routes, where now you can ride handlebar to handlebar, and now you have something like affiliation in improved relationship with one another. So here, a dad and a daughter, or a husband and wife, can ride handlebar to handlebar. Friends can, and talk about things. A completely different kind of riding. And I think it's one of my favorite illustrations of the difference between managing activity-based management and benefits-based management. And in the old days, it was the same thing. What are you managing for? Well, mountain biking. But here, it's mountain biking, but they're completely different activities because of the outcomes.
Very interesting. So the next question would be sort of, how does this actually then become implemented? How do you educate the public about these new benefits, and how they identify them for themselves, and then track that back into where they can, if they wish to do family bonding, for example? Will you have sort of like maps of areas where this is particularly relevant and possible?
Yeah, great question. A combination of things. On the one hand, what it means is that when we manage those areas, then we need to retain that setting. So part of the setting, the character of the setting, is that we don't overdevelop routes. We maintain the character of that setting, but so that's a question of managing the physical setting.
Mm-hmm.
Managing the social setting has to do with numbers of people. And if that's an issue for people, we need to address that. In this case, it's the administrative. It's the question of getting the information out about it. So, yes, we're not quite there in terms of implementation on that area, but we've been working with the local VCB, having discussions about that. How do we actually get the right word out? So it's really a question of here's another word we're not usually accustomed to, which is marketing. And it's not marketing as in selling more use, but it's marketing as in matching up people with the areas that have what they want. And it's really trying to facilitate getting people to the areas that can deliver the kinds of experiences and benefits they want. So it's a combination of things. It's how you manage, it's how you market, it's how you monitor, finding out are people getting what you said you would, and are we doing what we said we would do, and have we maintained that setting character, and then are all the administrative actions lined up to actually support those things rather than getting the cart before the horse. So it's pretty exciting, and it's pretty neat stuff, because people definitely identify with it, and they go, yeah, that's right, that's what we really value.
These are the values. I need a little rest. I want to get out there. I want to pedal hard and just burn off some energy, and or just I just want a little time with my family. Right. Those are actually values to us. It certainly is a different way to approach land management. So let's say you're in a community and you become aware of this. How can they start to participate in this process of benefits-based management?
Well, we've always had public involvement processes, Sydney, for the development of our land use plans, and that process continues. For these areas, as we move over to doing this, it's just a question of becoming involved and letting our recreation field staff and managers know what matters, what's important. It's a question not just of the activities, but the kinds of things people want out of that, out of those activities. And it isn't just a question of participants. It's a question of what about the affected communities? What do they get out of that? There's the question of stabilization of local economies through the economic infusion that comes from recreation and tourism. But there's also the question of what are you doing to my community? Can we retain the quality of life that we want? And what about the land out there? What are we doing to the land? It harkens back to that old metaphor, the golden goose and the golden eggs. These things have to be held in balance, so it's a matter of targeting a balanced array of outcomes. So it's really getting involved with the planners, the managers, and letting their wishes be known. If people are interested, they could contact their recreation planners and managers in the field offices. They could contact my colleagues in each of the other states.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you give that the BLM website? It's real easy.
www.blm.gov, and you could just click on offices and centers, and you're off and running.
It would have been fun to have been in some of the planning sessions when these things were being discussed. One of the things I would find interesting, and if you can put this in layman's terms, it would be terrific, probably because this is somewhat that's becoming bureaucratized now, there must be a master list of benefits.
there in fact is.
Yeah, and so just give us a sense, again, more in as close as you can in layman's terms, what are some of the benefits that, interestingly enough, are being discussed in these planning sessions for land management?
No, it's a great question. There is, if folks want to roll up their sleeves and get into this, they could go to the Venture Publishing website, and there's been several publications that have been put out that have some of this content in it. But in terms of just layman's language, for experiences, there's the old Recreation Experience Preference Scale that was developed by Dr. Bev Driver and Mike Manfredo up at CSU. There are things like developing your skills and abilities, enjoying risk-taking adventure, learning more about things here, enjoying getting away from family for a while, being near considerate people, enjoying feeling good about solitude, doing something creative, enjoying strenuous exercise, getting some needed physical exercise, and then, of course, there's the outcomes. There's the personal benefits, the psychophysiological, restoring my mind from unwanted stress, improving my mental well-being. There's the personal development and growth, things like improved sense of control over my life, improved leadership abilities, greater cognitive efficiency, more well-informed and responsible visitors, greater sense of responsibility for my own quality of life. And there's the whole personal appreciation and satisfaction, greater awareness of the importance of this place to my community, improved respect for the public lands or for private property, greater appreciation of the arts, greater sense of personal security, closer relationship with the natural world. And then there's the psychophysiological, the whole health thing, improved physical fitness and health maintenance, reduced incidence of disease, these kinds of things. And then there's, Sydney, we go into the household and community benefits. And these are things like reduced exposure to at-risk youth, improved community integration, enhanced lifestyle, increased nurturance or tolerance of others, heightened sense of community satisfaction, greater family bonding, improved parenting skills, more well-rounded childhood development. And then you get into the economic thing, reduced health maintenance costs, which matter to all of us, reduced absenteeism from work, improved local economic stability, greater local tourism revenue, and last but not least, the environmental benefits. Greater retention of the distinctive natural landscape features, reduced looting or vandalism of historic and prehistoric sites, greater protection of fish, wildlife, and plant habitat, greater recycling. The list goes on.
This is, quite honestly, and I'm being very sincere here, exciting to hear about, because what I sense happening, and it's great that it's happening now, couldn't happen at a better time, is for a real integration of the American spirit and land, and what's through this process of saying there is a relationship that exists between people and their land. In America, this is part of our great legacy through our public lands. And what I find really exciting is the fact that this is being formalized and defined and analyzed. And if I were king of the realm, what I would say is this needs to be integrated right into our schools so that school kids from the time they're small can start to think about these things in their backyard, the values that public lands have to them, so that they can integrate it from the time they're small and really get a sense of what America is about.
Well, that's true, Sydney. And what's exciting for me about this is that, of course, when one makes their career out of this, you do this because you don't do this, I suppose, to get rich. You do this because you have a commitment to it, because it's a sense of trying to hook up people with the things that matter to them. And, of course, we all, as professionals, came to love this because we experienced it ourselves first. Now it's the opportunity to get past the machinery of just management to actually help enrich people's lives. And it's in meaningful ways, in ways that really matter, and in ways that allow us to be able to balance these things. Someone had the old commercial, "There are no simple solutions, only intelligent choices." That's really what this is about. It's about trying to structure things and then hold ourselves accountable to really give our customers what they want. And it isn't just something that psychocentric, or it isn't just anthropocentric. It's a question of maintaining our stewardship responsibilities for the land itself as well, and to communities.
Well, this is very exciting. Now, if people wanted to help you out in your efforts and the BLM's efforts in bringing about a benefits-based management into the future here, how can they help you guys?
Well, there are a variety of ways, but I suppose the first way would be just to get involved. In fact, that's one of the benefits we've identified is improved community involvement in land use decisions. As people understand what we're trying to do, it's an opportunity for them to really help us identify what matters to their community. In fact, what's interesting, Sydney, is if you ask people what matters to them, they love to tell you, but the question has to be asked in a way in which they're free to be able to explore and identify what really matters. There was a thing identified some time ago which was called the recreation demand hierarchy, and Bev Driver and some of the other researchers that really developed this, from whom we got all of this, recognized that there's a demand for activities, there's a demand for experiences, and there's a demand for benefits. People are more in touch with their demand and their preferences for activities than they are for those other outcomes. But it's those other outcomes that affect quality of life and one's health and personal well-being that matter most. So I guess what I would say is let us help the customers and let the customers help us try to find out what really matters, and try to make sure that we have those things in mind when we write our management plans. Help us to structure not only the character of the recreation settings, but all of our actions, and make sure they fit in. And then, of course, because we're not sole source providers, it's incumbent upon ourselves as well as the communities for us to get together and make sure that all of the key providers are working off the same page.
Here's what I'm going to encourage people to do who've heard this particular broadcast, and that is, first of all, remember the term. It's called benefits-based management. Okay, everybody together all over the world. Now, benefits-based management. Remember that term, because when you walk into your BLM office, and you say, "I heard about this benefits-based management. I think it's a great idea. What can we do? What are you guys doing, or how can we help you implement this?" We have to take our sense of responsibility here, too, and let people know, particularly in government, that we really are in favor of this type of thing.
It's a good idea.
I'm so glad we've had a chance to learn more about this. We've been talking with Don Bruns, who is a recreation planner up in Colorado State Office of the BLM. Don, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News. Any final thoughts?
Just thank you, Sydney. It's great to talk about this. I always appreciate talking with anyone who's interested in finding out actually how they can better hook up with what matters to them and help us find out ways in which we can actually be more responsive. So it's great. I've said several times I've had to work my whole career to get to Recreation 101 because this is it. This is really what matters to our customers. It's what matters in terms of taking care of the land and being responsive to our communities. So this is it's good stuff.
Don Bruns, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sydney.
Nature is in the news. As a matter of fact, nature is becoming the story, as it always really has been. We'll keep you informed of all the news you need to know to care for your land, your spirit, and our future as members of this globalizing new world. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any day on the archives when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.